coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes. A World War II paratrooper remembers his first combat jump and why he couldn't wait to get through the door of that C-47.
Man, that plaque was something else. A piece of shrapnel comes through here, right out the other side. And I said, I'm going to get out of here.
Join us for an emotional journey with a guy still working in the oil fields at age 90. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor these brave men and women for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, we sure are educated and inspired by how much these people love our country. The guy we're going to hear from today just turned 90 years old, and we are sitting in the middle of an oil field. I can't say I've ever done this before, just north of Bakersfield, because this is where Walt Fies lives and works. You've been in the oil business since you got out of World War II, and I know they appreciate you out here at E&B. But let's talk about way back when. You were growing up a long way from Bakersfield, up in Northern California. I've never heard of Likely. Tell us where Likely, California is.
Altruz is a big town there, and 20 miles south of there is Likely. And that's where I lived on the ranch. We went to high school in Modoc Union High School in Altruz, California.
You know, I grew up in Las Banas, and people used to say, oh, you're from the bathrooms. I said, no, it's the baths. I bet when you're from Likely and you run into other kids, they say they probably had a joke or two about that hometown, huh?
Sure, they, oh, likely to do this, likely to do that, you know. All that kind of stuff.
Did you come from a big family?
I had two brothers. Myself, I was the oldest. My brother Bill in the Navy there. Yeah. And my brother Steve had a crippled hand. He didn't get in.
So what was it like growing up in Likely, California, before World War II?
It was nice. Spent every fall hunting deer back out in the hills. And that's one reason I'm still here, because I learned to go through the woods silently and everything. Go get them mule-tailed deer up there, 150 pounds apiece, you know.
Yeah, little did you know that hunting mule-tailed deer was preparing you for fighting the Germans, huh?
No, I didn't know it at that time, but it did, because it learned me how to drop down behind trees and sneak in behind bushes and stuff like that.
Yeah, Walt is a paratrooper from World War II. We're going to hear about that, how that happened. But I like to ask everybody about December 7th, 1941. And I'm guessing you were probably in your final year of high school when that rolled around, huh?
Modoc Union High School, they took us into the auditorium, gathered us all in there and turned the radio on. We listened to Roosevelt make his speech, you know, and about the dastardly day and day that we'll live in infamy and all that. So we stayed in there and did that. And then I went ahead and finished high school. And in 43, I entered the paratroopers.
You didn't wait around to get drafted? You volunteered yourself?
No, they drafted me, but I volunteered for the paratroopers.
Why paratroopers? And how'd you even know what a paratrooper was?
I just knew he jumped out of airplane. I thought it would be romantic to do, so I had it in my head, and nothing would stop me from it. So I went to it and ended up in Camp Tocoa, Georgia, training for paratroops with the 517th Parachute Infantry Combat Team.
People don't realize that this is something that really hadn't happened before World War II. They know that there were paratroopers in World War II, but I don't know that people realize how pioneering this was and how unprecedented it was. Did you have any idea of what you were getting yourself into?
Well, of course, those sergeants told us all that, you know. When we got to Fort Benning, Georgia, they had all these sergeants out there, and you go 1 hour at a time to each sergeant, and they teach you everything, judo, everything. Do that for 3 weeks, and then on the fourth week, you make your jumps. And so all them sergeants had speeches, nomenclature and care of your weapons and all that kind of stuff. Then we went, they took us out and pulled us up on them towers, you know. You might have saw that, where they pull you up on a tower 200 feet in the air and cut you loose and down you come.
Yeah, and those towers are still there at Fort Benning. I've seen the pictures, and our paratroopers today still jump off of them. Now, those towers initially came from the World's Fair, I think, right?
I think so, yeah. They're tall. Boy, they're big, yeah.
What does that feel like of the first time that you're up there and they put you out on that arm wide of the tower and drop you from 200 feet?
You're nervous, but you've been taught and everything. You just try to do what you've been told, and you come right on down and land. What they're doing with that is to fix you so when you hit, you learn to bend your knees. It's imperative that you bend your knees when you're falling in a parachute and you roll on your shoulder.
What would you say was the most difficult aspect of your training there?
14 or 16 weeks, whatever it was, of basic training at Camp Tocoa, Georgia. We got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and run 2.5 miles up Mount Chattahoochee, which is straight up, and run back down. And then we took a shower and ate breakfast. Sometimes we'd go forced marches with all of our packs on, go out all night long and everything. And so that was tough. But they taught us and made our bodies strong. That's what they did.
Well, I guess they had to make your body strong, and they probably had to make your mind pretty strong, because I don't know about you, but it might have occurred to me that if I'm jumping out of an airplane and landing behind enemy lines, that this is going to be some pretty dangerous duty I'm taking on.
I did it, and it is dangerous.
And as that training went on, were you getting anxious? Were you antsy to get over there and fight this war?
Well, yeah. You train so long, you get kind of anxious. We went up to Newport News, Virginia, got on that Grace Lines, Santa Maria. It was a Grace Lines from the West Coast, and they'd taken them all back there. And we was on the Santa Maria, and they took us over and took us through the Straits of Gibraltar and into Naples. So that when we got on a boat going over there, that was nice. Yeah, we knew we were on our way.
Did you experience combat before you ever jumped out of an airplane? They took you over to Naples by ship, so you didn't jump into Italy, but they landed you on the beaches of Naples.
Naples was free. We went and stayed in a volcano. The vacant volcano was nice and green in the bottom of it. They kept us in there. And then we went north to Rome, got out in the olive orchard east of Rome, and hit the Germans out there. And then we just kept fighting, kept go following them. And where we got in to the real battle was up at Grosseto. That's where Murphy got killed.
Yeah, let's hear about this, because your very first day of combat was, I mean, and I ask everybody, you know, what was that moment where you realized this is for real? Yeah. You had no choice, because you saw all kinds of things your first day of combat that most guys your age, 19, 20 years old, had never seen before.
Yeah, I was 19. Sergeant Bill Murphy was leading us, and run down and throw himself back of a stump because the Germans were shooting at him. I don't know what made him do it, but he just raised up, straight up, and looked over the top of the stump, and when he did, they shot him right between the eyes, and he fell, and with the back of his head all bloody and everything, and I run over there with the aid man, Anderton, all bloody and everything, with them white streaks in there, and I ask Anderton, what's them white streaks? And he says, that's his brains. So that was my first deal on my first day. That's how you get taught.
Yeah, that's not exactly the welcome you're looking for, and the rest of that story is there. Your life was in danger, too. In fact, you guys had to take out some Germans there to survive, right?
7 Germans, yeah. I was running back of Bill, and then all the guys were lined up like this around the top of that hill, and they were all firing. There was a lot of bullets going down in there, and we got them all 7 of them.
Do you remember feeling scared at all?
Well, you can't. You're so scared, but you're so busy, you push it to the back of your mind, and it has to stay there.
Give us a sense of how prepared you were. What were you armed with? What were you carrying?
I had a .45 on my hip, a trench knife on my left leg, and an M1 rifle in my hand. That's what I run down through there firing that thing at them Germans. Then I had a .32 Beretta in a shoulder holster under my left arm.
Give us a sense, if you can, for how constant this combat was, because that was your first day, but I know it wasn't your last.
Yeah, that whole day we went up over the hill and down on where the Germans were, and that whole day we fought hard. I remember a kid from New York named Fisher was our machine gunner, and we're taught, and they're taught, to shoot across the stomach, you know, because you hit somebody in the stomach and you don't kill them, but they have to pick them up and take them back, and you tie up a whole bunch of rear echelon people by taking care of them. So old Fisher was sitting there, and two guys was holding him, and had gauze all around his stomach. They tried to put him on the stretcher and straighten him out. No, and he wouldn't do it. So they had to carry him down to the ambulance in a sitting position and set him up in the ambulance, and he was still sitting, and he left, and about 2 or 3 months later, he came back.
So you see one of your buddies get shot through the head, and you have to see on your very first day of combat his brains scattered all over the place. Then another buddy gets basically sawed in half, and you see what happens to him. But you still don't allow yourself to think that it might be you next time.
That's a possibility every second. It takes a split second to get killed over there. And I was going down through them trees, and the leaves were just falling down off of them trees like a big storm, where all them bullets, see, they were down over there in the canyon by a house, and they were firing up that hill, and they were firing high over our heads, knocking all the leaves off of them trees. It was just like in a storm of trees, leaves falling. That's how many bullets were coming up through there.
How close did they come to hitting you?
I don't know. They didn't. That's all I care about. Yeah.
Was it at all difficult for you to get used to or come to grips with the fact that some of the bullets you were firing were going to take the enemy's lives?
That's what you're trying to do. I mean, you strive with all your being to do that. And if you do it better than they do, you're going to come out. We got through that night. We had cleaned them out of that house down there and everything. And I go around this big water tank. You know, I'd never seen any German spelling or anything. I go around the back of that tank and it says Drin Wasser. And I was surprised at that, how close their drinking water was to ours. It's Drin Wasser. There was a bunch of bushes over here, so it was getting dark. I go over there and lay down up in them bushes and sleep that night. Next morning, I get up and start to walk around that way to go. And there was a dead German laying right the other side of the bush with me all night long. I didn't even know it.
That gets your attention.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that shakes you up.
What kind of weather conditions did you guys have to deal with there in Italy?
Mostly rain. Windy and rainy. And see, Grosseto was a hill country. We were a light infantry combat team, you know. We carried everything with us, and we could go everywhere. So that's what the reason they sent us up there on them hills in there. We just kept going and going and going until we got about the third or fourth day. It sounds like a freight train going over us. And again, 30 minutes later, another freight train. What it was that long railroad gun that they had sitting down to sit at the Vecchia, and they were firing, trying to fire on us, but they were going over us and all the way over into the German position before it was coming down. That's how inaccurate they were with that thing. But it sounded just like you're standing on the ground, it sounded just like a freight train going through the air.
And I'm sure if you're listening at home, you're wondering just how big this gun was. Not quite as big as the infamous Gustav gun used against the Soviet forces on the Russian front, but pretty giant. There were two of them captured in Italy, Anzio Annie and the Anzio Express, and the Germans called them Leopold and Robert. The barrel, 71 feet long. If you go to Fort Lee in Virginia, you can actually see Anzio Annie for yourself. I have a photo on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. The shells were 11 inches in diameter and weighed 560 pounds apiece. Holy moly. And Mr. Fees, you heard it, then you actually got to see it.
By the time we got through there, we went to Città di Vecchia to kick off and go to southern France. They got in there with our airplanes and blowed everything to pieces. And that gun laid out across there just seemed like forever out through that lot. So I got to see that thing firsthand, right up close, after hearing it come over.
And I imagine after hearing it, you probably didn't need to see it to know how much damage it was capable of.
If you looked up there, you could just about see it going through the air. Those shells were that big. Man, they were big. And they fired, maybe several hundred rounds before the rain lifted and our planes got to them. See, that's what was our problem. The weather would stop them planes from coming in. Once we had a little clearing, then planes came in and got that thing because they knew where it was.
And you're describing things from your perspective, but I know you also have an understanding of the bigger picture and how fortunate you were to survive, because when you look at the guys that you went over there with, you were part of the minority that survived, right?
That's right. I came back with 11 others with the company. Of course, 30 or 40 of the others had been hurt and came to the States and got healed. And when we got to Camp Shanks, New York, they were there waiting on us.
But how many did you start out with?
I don't know. What is it? 131, I think. Was in the company. So me and 12 others came back with the company, then 30 or 40 more. But we were a full company because they just kept bringing in replacements all the time.
But from the original group, only a handful of you.
My buddies that I trained with, and we were just like brothers. We lived in the barracks, you know, and we loved each other. We'd die for each other if we had to. That's just the way it was. When we ended up, we were looking down across the valley to the Po River, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa was over there on the other side. You could see it cocked over this side like that. That's when they pulled us out, and the 99th Infantry Division relieved us, and we went and started getting ready to go invade southern France.
I know that you didn't leave Italy without some souvenirs, because I'm looking at one of them right over here. It's a beautiful 1940s-era phonograph. Where'd you get that?
I got that out of the USO in Rome, Italy, before we got in combat. And Bill Murphy and Edward Diss were with me with two other guys, and I was in the middle with my coat over that. And there's another story. When I got home with it, had it in my bag, and an MP up at Camp Beale was going to take it away from me, and I told him, no, you're not. I'm going to whip you if you do. So he went and got the officer, and the officer had common sense and says, it's his. Let him take it home. So I still got it.
Well, and that's a pretty big item to be carrying around all this time.
It's priceless to me because of Bill Murphy and Edward Diss. Edward Diss blew up a mortar 2 weeks later and killed himself. And then Bill Murphy got killed the first day of combat up there. So that phonograph is priceless to me. I wouldn't part with it for nothing.
I can see it reminds you of that, what could have been your fate and the price that's been paid, huh?
It's my tribute to them. They're my buddies, and they're not here, so, you know.
And you mentioned how Edward's life was claimed with an accident with his mortar. And you spent some time on a 60-millimeter mortar, too. When did that begin?
I fired thousands of rounds of 60-millimeter mortar over there. But this was out on a practice range, so they brought this bunch of shells out there, and some of them had rust around them on the point. You know where that button is on the point? Mm-hmm. On a mortar round has got a button on the point. When it comes down and hits, that explodes. And he dropped it in there, and it just smoked and fiddled and just barely come up and dropped out on the ground. And darn if he didn't grab it and stick it back in there, and when he did, it exploded and killed him right there.
Did you have to witness that?
Oh, yeah. We was off over there playing cards about 50, 60 feet away, and two of his men got hurt, got shrapnel in the back, but this was right close, and he just had holes all over him. Two of his crew got hurt, but this was the only one that got killed. Kid from New York City, Edward Diss.
One of the more than 405,000 Americans who did not make it home from the war. Walter Fees did make it home, but not without some more close calls. And we haven't even gotten to his first combat jump yet with the 517th Parachute Regimental Combat Team. That would come in Operation Dragoon in August of 1944. And we'll explore that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. One of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that their real sincerity and a genuine spirit are things that really make an impression on me. And that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years. I've heard them say it's all about serving their members, and then I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, EECU demonstrates over and over again what 200,000 members already know. EECU takes you personally. Go to myeecu.org to find out for yourself, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Today's interview taking place literally in the middle of an oil field north of Bakersfield, California. Maybe we should call our guest today 90-year-old Walter Fees the Well Whisperer, because from what I hear, his fellow employees at E&B Natural Resources in Bakersfield, guys like David Gifford, who introduced me to him, They say if there's a well that's having problems, they'll just take Mr. Fees out to it, and just from listening on the surface to what it's doing, he can diagnose exactly what's happening way down below. He never would have developed that expertise if he hadn't survived his paratrooper duty in World War II, and we're going to talk more about his first combat jump now. He'd already experienced combat in Italy, and he shared with us some of those gruesome moments when he lost close friends. But now it's August 15th, 1944. The Allies are invading southern France. Operation Dragoon is what we remember it as. But what do you remember about that first jump, going in behind enemy lines under the cover of darkness?
We went in at night. We loaded up about 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. We went across the Caspian Sea over by Nice, France, and then 15 miles into France. And there's two ridges there going this way. And they're like maybe 40, 50 miles across there. They were over 2,000 feet to go across these ridges. And then the planes were supposed to come in from the right like this and drop over and come down to 600 feet and jump us and then climb up and go out on the other side. But the Air Corps got scared. And when they come across those peaks, they just leveled off across there and jumped us more than 2,000 feet in the air. But before that, when we came in on the coast, man, that flak was something else. And I'm sitting there like this, and planes right over like this, about that far, and a big old piece of shrapnel comes through here, right out the other side. And I said, oh, Jesus, I want to get out of here.
So you're on a C-47?
C-47, yes, we had the one door.
So you're waiting in there to jump, and shrapnel comes within a foot or two of you?
Yeah, above my head here. I said, Jesus, I need to get out of here. And I could not wait. And I jumped, and I'm floating down through there, and I look down there, and there's the fog below us, and it looked like when they invaded Sicily, they had dumped two plane loads of paratroopers into the ocean. And so I looked down there and saw that fog, and so I grabbed my T5 pack. You got a T5 pack here, and you turn it, open it, and it drops, and then you just put your arms straight down like this and hold yourself in the chute. And then when you get within 15, 20 feet of the water, you throw your arms straight up, and the chute goes off that way, and you go straight down. Because if you go straight down with that chute, it'll take you under and you never get up. So I'm all ready to do that, and all of a sudden I just sat down. I didn't even fall. I sat down in a plowed grape vineyard where it was all plowed up in the middle, you know. Yeah. I just sat down on it and never even fell down. And so that's the kind of luck I had.
So you're expecting a splash that never came, huh?
Splash never came. So then Bob Rock was there. Me and Bob Rock, we were both big guys. Bob Rock was 6'2". They put me and him in the back of the stick. You know what a stick is. It's 16 men, and you go out the door. And they put me and Bob Rock back there, and whenever that green light come on, we just started going forward and pushing just as hard as we could because we wanted to get out fast. And so Bob Rock was right in back of me, and I get to looking around for him. I holler at Bob, where are you? And I'm up here on the hill. He's on the hill, you know. And
this is in the middle of the night. It's all dark.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's 5 minutes to 5 in the morning when we jumped. So Bob Rock's hollering. We're hollering back and forth, and all of a sudden I hear shh, 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 going through the air, and I see these tracers going about 50 feet above us. And it's a German machine gun over there shooting at us, but he just didn't know what the hell he was doing. And so Bob come down off of there, and the side of his face was all bloody from hitting a tree and everything. And there, I hit that right in between the vineyard and never even fell down. So that's just the luck I had. I was lucky all the way.
And this is something that's always fascinated me with all the paratroopers I've spoken with, is jumping is nerve-wracking enough. Then you get on the ground. Yeah. And you got to figure out where in the world you are and where the enemy is.
Yeah, well, we had the compass. During training, they had taken us to Tennessee and dreamt us in the middle of Tennessee with nothing but our compasses on and a list of readings to go by. It was a 3-day trick to get to Cookeville, Tennessee. And we were back out in those mountains, so we learned in the States how to do that. We know we wanted to go south to go straight to the ocean to meet those Germans coming up. See, with 15 miles in, that's what they do with the paratroopers. You jump way back there and you form your line and everything. Then the ships come on the shore in the morning at day of the bridge break and start pushing them back. And then when the Germans come back over that hill, there we were waiting for them. Man, about noon, that big old cut over there and a big old cut like this over there. Looked over there and that highway was just solid with trucks coming and looked like ants all over that hill where the Germans were coming. But just before that, Carl Salmon, our sniper, had went over there sniping them and everything. And about an hour later, the Jeep comes back with Carl laying on top of the hood with a bullet between his eyes. So, you know, just nothing, everything to shake you up. So here, we look over there, and all them Germans are coming, and then we look up above us, and there's these funny-looking planes circling over us. See, there was 5,000 of us, 5,000 British. These planes were circling over us, and so they're going to bomb us. Anyway, they circled over us, and here they went, over there bombing those Germans. And it was that British mosquito-light bomber they had. And there were six of them, and they just bombed the hell out of those guys over there. We're up on a hill covering a big grape vineyard, I mean like 2,000 acres or so. And all of a sudden, we looked out through there, and that whole grape vineyard was moving where the Germans were coming through it. And so we're laying up there. I'm popping my mortar right and left and everything. And then all of a sudden, vineyard just started disappearing from down at the other end all the way up through there. And it was the 442 up above us that Japanese American boys setting up there with their 4.2 mortars, and they just demolished that vineyard and all of them Germans in there. I went out through there, and there was over 200 of them dead in there, and it was those boys. So later on, whenever we left and went back, I go up through there, and there's the gliders that they came in on, and one of them was sitting like this up in the air, and there was 16 bodies laying under it with parachutes on them. Anybody got killed, you covered them with their parachute. There were 16 of them laying there under that the edge of that glider. But the 442, they were something else.
Well, and we've spoken to some of those 442nd Regimental Combat Team vets on this program, the guys whose families, for the most part, were in internment camps, and here they are risking their lives and, in many cases, giving their lives overseas. It sounds like you're saying that you're not sure you'd be here without the 442nd.
No, we wouldn't have been, because they had sneaked in back there in them gliders. See, I came in the first wave, which is one reason why I'm still here. It was dark, and we landed for anybody could even see us and everything. And then the third and fourth wave of the paratroopers coming in, they got hell shot out of them. And then the gliders came in with them. When they jumped, they jump out, and the gliders are towing that back of them. They turn the gliders loose, and they come down. So they brought them 442 in by gliders. And I know they must have had high casualties, too. It's nothing but good to say about the 442. They're a fine group of young men, American men.
Amen. Well, and just hearing you describe all this, I can tell how real this all still is and how clear your memory is, and you're painting a powerful picture for the rest of us. So you'd been in Italy. Now here you are fighting the Germans in southern France. But you weren't quite done yet, huh?
No, we started back up through there, across the hills and into a valley over there. And I go down by this house, and I'm setting up my mortar there. And I look over across there about a mile, and there's a convoy of German trucks going up the other side of the river, up through that little town. So I set up my mortar and I started blasting hell out of them trucks. And I look up and here's six guys all dressed in black with armbands on, with dirty clothes on and everything, and carrying weapons on slings and everything, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They had been in there helping us, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They all came up and hugged us. That was nice.
Some people might not know what that means, what you're talking about.
Well, the Mach-E is the French resistance, and they were tough. They were tough boys. They hated the Germans so bad that it was far worse than we did, probably, because they had killed their women and everything, you know. They were just hugging us and everything. We give them grenades and all that kind of stuff.
So here you are. You're 20 years old. You fought your way through Italy and jumped behind enemy lines into southern France. And yet, now you look back and say, man, the Battle of the Bulge hadn't even happened yet, because you would be tested in that one, too. How did that unfold?
Down there in southern France, we turned to the right, went up these hills, these twisted roads that the trucks had to pull forward and back up, go around the turn and everything, up to the top of the Alps Maritimes. And we tangled with the Germans up there. One morning they took me down about 4 or 5 miles down this road and set me up on a little crossroads there and said, now there's about 50 Germans out there laying mines, and we got to stop them. And so my observer says, drop one in and go about 3,000 yards. So I dropped it in and went 3,000 yards. And he said, now bring it back about 150 yards and get it on this side. And then if they don't give up, you drop one in the middle. So I said, hell with this. I dropped it back 50 yards and dropped it in, and it was over. Killed three of them. The rest of them gave up, and they came up through there. And you would not believe that they were ragged, dirty kids about anywhere from 17 to 19 years old, maybe even 16, in the German army, forced in there, and they had them out there. Man, they were crying and everything else, scared the hell out of them. So, and then right after that, we they brought us down off of that hill, and we got on the 40 and 8s and started towards Lille, France for a 14-week vacation, which never materialized because of the Battle of the Bulge.
So you think you're going to get a much-deserved break after everything you've been through, and then they say, hey, we're running out of guys, we need more.
Yeah, they came in Tuesday of the second week and took all of our automatic weapons and mortars and everything and put them on trucks and sent them to the Battle of the Bulge to help those guys. See, those guys up there were getting the hell knocked out of them from them tanks. And so then next night, about 5 o'clock, they're loading us in. During the day, they brought in truckloads of stuff to replace our ammo and stuff. And 5 o'clock the next night, we're loading up in trucks and heading towards the Battle of the Bulge.
Merry Christmas, huh?
Yeah. Merry Christmas. We get up there, and we've traveled all night long and got out of a truck and walked around towards the front. And there's a bush there, a dead German laying on top of it. And I said, here we are again. And they came to us and they said, well, there's a town up 5 miles up here. It's got 17 Germans in it. We want you to go up and run them out and occupy that town. So off we go. We run up there, and we run right into a regiment that had come in while there was just, that 17 was just the front echelon getting things ready for them. And so they were all set up there waiting on us when we got there. And they run us back to the town we jumped off from, and we were surrounded there for 9 days.
How many of you?
Well, Company C, 100 and whatever was left there, 80, 90 men by then, maybe.
So when you say surrounded for 9 days, maybe people say, oh, 9 days, that's not a long time. But if you're surrounded and you don't know if you're ever getting out, that sounds like an awful long time to me.
Well, when we come running back down that railroad track back to that town, we look out across there, and there's a big plateau out there. It's all rugged country, big deep thing with a river going down through it. And out on the other side is a big plateau, and out across there is 5 Tiger tanks coming. And I'm there at this first house, standing by the house, rigging up my mortar, and I hear that zipping again, you know. I look up in the air, and there's them tracers going by about 30 feet in the air. If they could have shot, if they were good shots, you know, a lot more of us would have been dead. But they were atrocious shots.
Not that you're complaining.
No, not complaining. So anyway, by the time they realized what was going on, we were gone. We were back in the house. And we looked up, and here come a bunch of P-38s. You know what P-38 is, a double body deal. And they were circling over them tanks, and they started bombing all around there and missing them and everything. All of a sudden, the tank right in the middle just disappeared. You know, they just must have had all there was big old pieces of scrap iron around there. And so, and the mother 4 turned around and back out into the woods they go. Otherwise, we were going to really be in it. If they'd got out there up against that bank of that river shooting across at us, we'd have been in trouble.
Yeah, I sense a pattern here. There are a lot of points where you guys were bailed out or rescued, whether it's the 442nd or those P-38 pilots. Oh, yeah. But tell me about, so this is December and January, and that coldest winter that's so infamous at the Bulge.
We were surrounded right through Christmas of 1944.
What were your living conditions? Did you have shelter?
I was inside a house. There's a story there. I was telling you about that .32 Beretta I carried. I was laying there, and you know me, I was under the table, under the kitchen table, sleeping. And they had come to us and told us, now, the Germans are sneaking in and talking in broken English, like wanting to know if you could come in and keep warm or get milk or something like that. In broken English, and then when you answered them, they shot you. So anyway, I'm laying there, and all of a sudden, I hear a door opening over there, and it says, please, milk for baby. And I said, oh, Jesus. So I just reached and got that .38 and reached around the leg of that table and busted one off, and I shot it right above his head. And he disappeared, and everybody, all my buddies laying around there jumped up and everything, what the hell going on there? And they seen where I hit that facing there, and they went in there, and there was a well-concealed door, and this guy and his wife and his mother and 2 little kids, one of them was a baby, was down in that cellar there for days. We didn't even know about it. And it just scared him to death. Anyway, they went down there and got him and brought him back up, and I apologized and everything. But, you know, they did tell us that. They did tell us that the Germans were doing that. 2 of my buddies went out in the houses over there. There's a shack right at the back of the house, and the cows are in there. So they went out there with that guy and stood and guarded him while he milked the cow and got a bunch of milk, and the women came up and went through the kitchen getting all kinds of stuff and everything, and they just disappeared back through the door. We never saw them again. And a couple nights later, we got attacked coming down the hill, and there was hedgerows all up and down in between each alfalfa field. You know, like us, we have a bump, but they have a hedgerow, and then in between that, they're mowing the hay and stuff, you know. So down through there came these Germans all over the place. And one of our machine guns was over there, machine gunning out the window and everything. And I look around this house here, come a guy, stuff hanging all over him and clothes all over him. And he comes around there and he looks up there at that machine gun of ours and raises his gun. And we was all, I had a carbine at that time. And we all started firing at him. And he just raised his gun like that and then he just ran down over on his face. Our gunner looked out the window, looked down there, looked over at us, waved, turned around, started shooting again. And our Lieutenant Allingham, he goes over there to lead a squad up there to finish cleaning up the Germans over there. And he's going up one side of the hedgerow, and a German sticks a gun through there and shoots him. And he fell right there, so that dang German reached through there and pulled a pin on his phosphorus hand grenade. We had all them hand grenades hanging on us, you know. And he pulled a pin on the phosphorus hand grenade, and Lieutenant Allingham was burning there way up in the night. And that's another terrible thing.
Yeah, I think we can all imagine how things like that can get seared into your memory and you can't unsee them. I want to ask you a little more about that incident in the home with the German civilians, but it's break time again. The rest of Walter Fee's World War II paratrooper story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with World War II paratrooper Walter Fees of Bakersfield, California. One story he shared before the break was how, sleeping under the kitchen table of a German home while surrounded by the enemy, he heard a German voice ask for milk for a baby. It was civilians who'd been hiding in the basement. And did that encounter give you a little perspective, perhaps, on what those people must be going through?
Well, that shakes you up. That day, they had told us about that. Then that same night, this guy comes out there and he says, "Want milk for baby?" We was the best in the world, though. They came up and got all their stuff and everything, and they were all happy with us, letting them come and get all their food and stuff.
And you've known all along that you're fighting for your country, but I bet that helped you understand that there are some more people that you're fighting for.
That's right. We were protecting them, too.
All the Battle of the Bulge veterans that I've spoken with have something to say about the weather and how brutal it was. Did you have to deal with it much?
We had 2.5 to 3 feet of snow all of the time. We was never on the ground. The second night after this deal with the Beretta, they came and said that the tanks were coming in, so a string of tracks 16 miles long, the 7th Armored Division, but they were 300 or 400 yards in between each tank, you know. It would come around way over the woods over there and come around the big circle, and come up and stopped at the edge of town. Then a tank could run through up there fast as it could and stop. Then five of us run out and get on it, and away they'd go. So that's how dangerous it was. You couldn't go out there and wait on a tank. I mean, you just run out and got on there, and away he was gone. And they got us out of there, and it took us all night long down through there. We were 9 miles to our lines.
Well, and before those tanks came, when you realize you're surrounded and it goes from day one to day two and all of a sudden it's day seven, eight, nine. Yeah, and they're shooting at you every day. Were you starting to wonder if you'd ever get out of there?
Well, what happened, Bob Rock got wounded on the second day and they put him on an ambulance. The ambulance goes out and everything. And we got a radio call from Bob Rock. He says, don't do anything. You're surrounded. Said we went through the German lines because we didn't have any guns on us or nothing, but they let us go, but you're surrounded. So that's how we knew we were surrounded. We had quite a few wounded, little hits and this and that and there. And I never was. I never got hit. So all of them walking wounded, they just got on the tanks and went out with us.
In all these battles that you endured through this time, what do you think was the closest you came to not being sitting here in this oil field talking to me right now?
The one I'm going to tell you about when we infiltrated through to get the Screaming Mimes, that was it. I'd fired my mortar. All six of my ammo bearers had been wounded. We lost 30% of our company that night. Six dead, Sergeant Jacqueline and Wren got hit in the back of the head because bullets going every which way. And then there was four others besides that. And then we had 30% wounded. Captain Lodges A and Major Boyle was in the front going to the Screaming Mimes, and they got machine gunned across the chest. But when I got back to the United States from the ship going to the restaurant, they were standing at the top of the plank greeting us, so they made it. But we had a lot of wounded that night, man. A lot of wounded.
And did you actually feel or see something coming close to you, or just saying because of the sheer numbers of other guys that went down?
Well, down there in southern France, I was laying in my hole. Shrapnel came through the air, making all that kind of, when they're just about dead, they just make a hell of a noise, you know. And it hit me right here. It was hot, and it hit hard enough to hurt, you know. So I reached in under my coat and felt, and everything was fine. And it was just a spent round to hit me right there.
Right under your right armpit.
That's as close as...
Close enough, huh?
Then up there that night, we was taking on Screaming Mimes. I put my water canteen on top of my hole like that so I could drink out of it. And the next morning, there was a hole through it, and no water was gone. It was just frozen. There's just a hole through it. So that's as close as I came.
Well, with what I've heard about the snow and ice during the bulge, I'm surprised the bullet got through that frozen ice. I understand you also got to see and experience the V-1 buzz bomb back there?
During that deal up there in the Battle of the Bulge, we were over towards the age, and I was outside of this house on guard duty, and I hear that putt-putt-putting in the air, and four or five of these buzz bombs was going over with a big yellow flashing back them, and they'd get over the other side of us a little ways and shut off, and then a second later you'd hit an explosion. We've seen lots of those things. And up there in one of these battles, Wilkins got hit in the butt by shrapnel, and they brought him down and was dressing him up and everything, and they said they're going to send him to England. We was all kidding him. You got it made. You're going to England and everything. And we was all laughing and playing with him and everything. And he leaves, and a month later we hear that he got over there in London, and one of them big high-flying ones came through and come down and took the ward out he was in, killed him. Just how things worked.
Yeah, and somehow, even though we've heard story after story of how it could have been you and something came to your rescue, you kept surviving. Why do you think that is? Why do you think you've been able to have this life and now have literally about 100 descendants here that never would have existed?
I thank God kept me so I could repopulate the Central California.
And you have. So you had seven kids, and you have more than 40 grandkids and 40 great-grandkids. You even have some great-greats?
Yeah, there's about, with the in-laws and everything, there's well over 100 of them.
And they were all there to celebrate your 90th birthday. But let me get the end of the war story for you, because you had a special someone you wanted to get back to, and you wrote to her and said, hey, I'm only going to be home for a short time because we have to go invade Japan. And when did you find out that you wouldn't have to do that?
The second night out on the USS Oneida Victory, from the heart of France, we got over the ship's message board, we got Hiroshima had been bombed. The next night, we got the same message that Nagasaki had been bombed and the war was over. And we were on our way to, we were going to have a month home, and I sent my wife $350 and told her to meet me out there because I had to see my mother. And I go in up the lane and the door pops open and here she comes. So and then she's been there ever since. She's up there in the graveyard up in Kerman, California.
And if those bombs hadn't have dropped, you never would have made it home to see her or have any of those kids or grandkids. And I've talked to a lot of veterans who say the atomic bomb saved their life because of those estimates that, you know, a million Americans and countless more Japanese would have died. But you're pretty sure about yours, because you would have been jumping behind enemy lines out of a plane again?
Oh, sure. That's what we did. We'd been 15 miles in off of one of them shores up there, putting up a line to sketch the Japanese as they came back off the ocean. But it never happened, so that was good.
So I imagine you were probably a fan of Harry Truman, huh?
We thought Harry Truman was it. Yeah, that's for sure. So we just went home and went up to Camp Beale, California, and they sent me home and kept sending me an extension. And then in December in 45, I went back and they discharged me and gave me my money, $700-$800. And I went back to Kerman and started living.
I want to get the story of how you ended up in the oil business, because you're still in the oil business at age 90. But after everything you'd been through, and they discharged you, they gave you that combat infantry badge, they even gave you the good conduct medal, so you must have been doing all right. Was it difficult, though, with everything you'd been through, to here be a 21, 22-year-old guy trying to get on with life after all those intense experiences overseas?
One experience, me and my wife was sleeping in bed flat on our backs. She was beside me, and I wake up, and she's shaking me. She said, "What the hell are you doing?" And I was laying there fighting Germans on a dam, and my arm was coming up and down like this, hitting her. And she woke me up. So that's the way it was. You dreamt. For many months, you dreamt every night. Yeah, it doesn't go away that fast, you know?
I know it's not easy to talk about those things, but I think it's important for the rest of us to understand that this isn't something you left over there. It's something you've had to carry with you.
Yeah, for two or three years, maybe three or four, maybe. And then I got busy working in the oil fields and raising kids, and you know, it just goes away slow.
What was it about working in the oil fields that you enjoyed so much? Because I imagine if you're still out here at age 90, you must enjoy it.
Well, it's you're always thinking. You're working 5,000 feet below the surface, figuring what's going on down there. And by now, I know what's going on. And just something to keep you thinking, and it's good money, real good money. And so I just stayed in it. I raised all my kids working in the oil fields, and I'm still doing it.
How would you describe your expertise? Because I hear, if anyone around here has any questions, they come to you.
I worked 20 years for Oil Well Service Company on rigs. In 1973, I quit and went up there above Oakhurst up there and built me a nice big place on a mountain up there. And then these guys come to me and wanted me to come over there and help them. So in 74, I came over there and went to help them. Everything looked so good over there, and they treated me so good that I just stayed there, and I'm still with them. That's 38 years ago. And it's the best company in the oil fields. They give bonuses. Every third month, they give bonus. They get one for Christmas, and then they pay you good. So, like here, they furnish me my house.
I've got to ask you the question. If you just turned 90, and you're still doing this, are you ever going to quit?
I'm going to quit when they carry me out the door. Yeah, that's exactly what's going to go on. But I fully, like I told all them kids up there the other day, I'm going to be standing up here 10 years from now, and I want you all to be here healthy and happy. And so they just about tore the roof off that place.
Yeah, celebrating your 90th birthday. Well, I'm sure you have countless more stories that you could tell. I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for being real with us and sharing what it was really like as a paratrooper. Is there anything else that you think we need to know about you and all those guys that you served with in World War II?
Well, one night, the same night I was seeing those B-1s come over, there was a bomber coming about 300 or 400 feet off the ground around there in the moonlight with a guy sitting up out there in the grass looking down, looking for any kind of a light so they could drop their bombs. And then we were all standing down there in the dark watching him, and the moon was shining. You could see him sitting up there about 300 or 400 feet in the air. Just see him sitting there in the front of that bomber. It was amazing.
That was an American bomber?
Oh, no. It was a German bomber looking for us.
Good thing he didn't see it.
Sure was.
What are you most proud of?
Oh, I'm real proud of being there and where it worked out so successfully for me. And to know, you know, I think about my buddies over there all the time, the guys that I would die for. And they're laying over there. It's been 70 years. They're laying over there in them graves. And it breaks my heart, but that's the reason I wanted to do this, so I could bring some of their names to the top for people to know about them. Oh, we was up there in between a bunch of rocks in Italy, and we were all standing there kind of resting and everything. Ed Lang was a big, tall kid, real muscled up and everything. He was standing over there in back of that rock, and a bullet comes in, hits one of them rocks over there on the side, ricocheted, and hit Lang right there, and came out over here, right, just tore his heart out. So that just goes to show you how things happen. He was in the back of a rock and should have been protected. But the guy was so far off, his bullet hit that rock and ricocheted and just hit poor old Lang right in the side and come right up through his heart and tore it right out. So that's another one that's terrible.
Without a doubt, and I know I felt it, I'm pretty sure all the folks listening at home felt your sincere emotion when you said your motivation for doing this interview was to honor your friends who did not make it home. Well done, sir. That's Walter Fees, 90 years old, of Bakersfield. You can find photos of him then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Out of time this time, but join us again next time when yet another veteran explains in his own words why those four words are as true as ever. Freedom is not free.
I told you about that plane. When we were in that ACAC, man, that was tough. They were just blowing us all over the sky and everything. And I said, boy, if I ever get out of this, I'm not going to get up in another plane. But I had to, because when the war was over, I went in. I got out of the hospital and I went to my unit, and they told me, he said, we got a jump tomorrow. I said, what are you talking about, a jump? They said, Eisenhower is going to show off his paratroopers. And I said, well, I just got out of hospital. I can't make a jump. He said, you've been in rehabilitation for 2 months. That you're going to make a jump. So I went and I made the jump. And we, this big canyon with a creek down the middle of it. And 16 guys got hurt. You know, every time you make a jump, a big jump like that, 16 to 20, 25 guys gets hurt. Broken legs, hit trees. And all that. So we got 16 guys hurt, and I look up on the top of the hill there, a real sharp hill and a big old road right to the top of it, and there was like 50 of these damn limousines with the signs on them and everything. And right out in front of them was Eisenhower, pointing in the air and everything at his paratroopers coming down, and De Gaulle was there with him, and De Gaulle was a foot and a half taller than him. You know, his big old De Gaulle. And then Patton was there, and Montgomery was there, and it was that damn Eisenhower showing off his paratroopers, and 16 guys get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we were against.
Yeah.
But we didn't mind making a jump for him. But every time you jump, 16, 20, 25 guys gets hurt, little hurts, you know, like a leg slashed open and. Or a branch stuck through into your stomach or something, but I just thought that was amazing, and then that was it. Right after that, we went to Le Havre, France, and got on the boat and came home.
So you haven't been on a plane since?
Nope. Well, while I was on that one,
yeah.
I was on that one because I had to.
Right.
But I had already vowed that I wasn't. I haven't been on a plane since, and that's the reason I don't go to the memorial, because after all these years that I haven't been on a plane, I don't want to get on a plane and have it go down and take everybody else with me, have us all go down. So that's just one of my things. I guess you call it, I'm scared or what, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just one of them things.
Well, if you change your mind, let us know.
Oh, I will. Thank
We'd
you.
Love to get you there.